This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 7 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have one of the most well-known and respected reporters in the NBA, ESPN's Brian Windhorst, joining us on the podcast. And you can obviously see Brian all over ESPN on Get Up and First Take. He also hosts Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective podcast. Brian, I'm sure this is one of the busiest times of the year for you. I really appreciate you taking some time to join us today. Off the top of your head, do you know how many NBA finals you've covered now?
Probably like 12-ish. Do I get to count the 2020 finals? I was not in the bubble. I was covering it on Zoom. I don't know how you count 2020, but
yeah, if we get to count it for LeBron and the Lakers, I think we'll count it for you.
Yeah, so that one's a little bit unusual, but this is like some in the neighborhood of a dozen.
Had you been to Denver much for ESPN and to cover Nuggets games prior to the Western Conference Finals this year?
I hadn't been to Denver since the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, I've covered stuff in Denver before. I had never covered a playoff game in Denver until game one of the NBA. Typically I cover the Eastern Conference. I have covered some Western Conference playoff games. I've covered the Suns quite a bit the last couple of years, but it was my first playoff game ever in Denver was game one.
And obviously LeBron is great for business, but have you been able to almost enjoy the fact that with LeBron not being in the finals or even necessarily in the playoffs too much in recent years, that you've been able to cover other teams and other stories more?
Yeah. I mean, I think the finals in the post LeBron era, which was 8 in a row, I mean, those were amazing years. Amazing competition in many of those years, not everyone. But I think like the 2019 finals, which unfortunately was marred by injury, but you know, the experience of having Toronto win that was awesome. Last year, I thought there was great competition in between Boston and Golden State. You know, Golden State was behind in the series and had to come back to win, won in Boston to close it out. And this year, you know, we're going to have either a brand new champion in Denver or a team in Miami that will have pulled off one of the great playoff runs in history. So I wish the Celtics the last couple of years would have made up their mind about how they were going to play in certain series, so they wouldn't have dragged out to all these games, because that's extraordinarily taxing on everybody involved. And I think was a anchor on the Heat to start this series. I think it's going to be an entertaining series. I think we're headed for at least 6 games. Could be wrong. Yeah. But I feel good about the nature of the series. And I think it'll be, you know, I think it's refreshing. I think it's refreshing to see new faces. And I think the world is, you know, discovering, you know, Jokic, who despite winning 2 MVPs was still a little bit, underappreciated, I think, by the average basketball fan. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore as his talents are on display for the whole world.
Yeah. And I think the national media has been kind of criticized a bit for the way that Jokic and the Nuggets have been covered throughout the playoffs. And there's always this notion that ESPN covers LeBron too much, but after 20 years or so of covering LeBron, I would imagine ESPN has some semblance of data to back up that decision-making of why they cover LeBron so much.
Well, first off, I know that the Nuggets fans like to play the card that they are underappreciated or whatever. But when you win 2 MVPs, you're not winning the MVP award if you're not being appreciated by the national media.
Right.
There's 100 votes that come out of that choose the MVP award. And I think 4 or 5 of them are forwarded to the Denver market. So I think we might have been aware of who Nikola Jokic was. Don't go crazy. But I think when you get the MVP award, it kind of means you're not overlooked. And If you get two in a row, it might mean that we've seen you just a little teeny bitsies. So I think it's hilarious that the Nuggets fans play that card. But whatever. They're not on national TV a lot because, you know, the marketplace doesn't dictate it. The marketplace says that, you know, more fans are interested in the Lakers and the Warriors than they are the Nuggets. And, you know, I'm from Cleveland. I live in Omaha. You're not going to find somebody. I used to live in Miami, New York, and left both places. So you're not going to find somebody who's more, you know, middle America focused than myself. And I will just say that, why do the Nuggets take three-pointers? Because the data says it's a good idea. Why does ESPN talk about the Cowboys and the Lakers? Because the data says it's a good idea. So, right. But hey, listen, the Nuggets fans haven't experienced this before. And so I am totally down with them totally soaking it up. And they had that 9-day window where they could just bask in it. And, you know, I got to see, I've seen this over the years in some places that get to enjoy success after many years of non-success. I mean, believe it or not, there was a time when the Warriors didn't make the playoffs for like 20 consecutive years. Or like, I think made it one out of 17 years or something like that. And there was a time where their fans were just completely in a whole new world of making it this deep. Now they're used to it, but the Toronto fans were the same way. The Milwaukee fans, I mean, the Milwaukee went almost 50 years. I think it was 47 years between finals appearances. Almost nobody going to those games had known the experience of going to the finals. And the night where they won it in 2021, and there was like 40,000 people in the street outside the arena. Come on. That's an iconic night for the city of Milwaukee. So if Denver gets to have that moment, I hope they do enjoy it. Do we pay as much attention to the Nuggets as we do the Lakers? No. If the Nuggets win the title this year, will we pay as much attention to the Nuggets next year? No. That's the nature of the marketplace and the media. But and by the way, the Nuggets fans have reason. They can certainly point out different things that happen and say, boy, disrespect here and there. And they're totally right about that. But the idea that the national media didn't know who Jokic was is a little bit, I don't think that's quite accurate, but you know, they can own it. They can enjoy it while they have it right now.
Some of that criticism did come from ESPN itself, though. JJ Redick has complained about it a little bit on First Take with so many of the topics that you're asked to debate center around the Lakers and LeBron. And Kendrick Perkins has now even came out and said that he thinks ESPN and himself needs to do a better job of covering Jokic. I mean, personally, I don't think it's ESPN's job to promote Jokic or the Nuggets, especially for debate shows that are sold as entertainment. But while the Nuggets fans are probably the loudest critics, like there are other people, and it's come from ESPN talent themselves.
That's the nature of the business. it's just the nature of it when you're trying to cover all those sports and all those teams. But I think the ratings have been pretty solid in the first couple games. I imagine that they'll even be better as now that people have seen this is actually going to be a series. And, you know, there was a time when people didn't know about the Splash Brothers. Like the Splash Brothers were really good. I mean, people knew about Steph Curry because he was college, but like the Splash Brothers were terrorizing the NBA and people weren't necessarily seeing it every day.
Right.
It's the nature of building yourself up that happens. And so I love this. I love this natural, organic way about it. I think to win a championship building organically is the most rewarding way to win. And the Nuggets are on the verge of it. And so, like I said, with the Bucks won it the same way. And it makes the championship so rewarding. And so, like, if they do it, it's an incredible opportunity. And, you know, regardless of counting the topics on First Take, once you win a championship, it's you know, the ultimate moment. So I don't think that really, in the grand scheme of things, matters. But I do think there are more people who live in Los Angeles and New York than there do in Denver, and that's not changing in the next year. And that will be reflected in probably the way the national media covers the sports leagues.
Right. And it's even honestly, it's reflected on how Awful Announcing covers the sports leagues and the media as well. I think part of the reason why it's a big story for us that the Nuggets or at least Nuggets fans feel like they've been neglected is the fact that we can then also put LeBron James in the headline as well. Like the fact that we can say, well, right. They cover LeBron James more. If the argument was that they're covering Giannis more, like I honestly don't even know if that's such a big story for
like, here's the thing. Here's a reality that nobody wants to say. If you really, really only wanted to pander to the data, you would literally do all of the basketball shows only about the Lakers.
Right.
You would literally do if you only wanted to not focus on anything but what the data said, if you truly wanted to, you know, sell the most soap, and again, this is somebody, I live in Omaha, Nebraska, from Cleveland, you know? So, I mean, I'm just telling you that, you know, that's the reality. But,
right.
You know, as somebody who has the NBA rights, I think, you know, if you look at the menu of ESPN offerings, we do significant comprehensive coverage. I will put forth our comprehensive coverage against everybody except maybe The Athletic. And really, The Athletic is a patchwork of local sites that make it into to turn into a national site. Like, The Athletic has way more reporters than ESPN does. But other than that, like if you watch NBA Today, which covers a much more wide variety of it, if you listen to the podcasts, which are also, we have on YouTube as well, we cover all of the teams. I mean, Zach Lowe is one of the most popular writers at ESPN, and he will sometimes go on for 500-600 words about the Utah Jazz pick and roll scheme, and it will be on the centerpiece of ESPN.com. It won't be on the centerpiece of ESPN.com as often as LeBron is, but I will stand on our overall coverage of the NBA over the course of the 12 months of the year and say we do hit all the nooks and crannies. Just it may not be on the, you know, most front-facing platforms at every second of every day of the year.
Sure. Yeah. And obviously, I totally get those front facing platforms, why there is such a focus on the Lakers and the Cowboys and LeBron. Like I said, we do it too at Awful Announcing, where you definitely see the benefit when you get those big teams and big names in a headline. Just being that I mentioned ourselves, how do you feel about the aggregate media? I'm curious.
Well, we are aggregators as reporters. I mean, we listen to 7, 5-minute interviews after a game, and then we pluck the 3 quotes out of it and say, here. That's part of what we do. I mean, part of what aggregation is being thoughtful, and presenting the newsworthy aspects and, looking at a game or a news event, deciding whose perspectives are newsworthy and relevant and putting it out there. So part of, the basis of reporting is aggregating. You're aggregating all the information and presenting it to the consumer. I think what has happened in the, specifically the world of radio and podcast aggregation is oftentimes been irresponsible because the complete stripping of context in a context rich environment is oftentimes harmful. And it has completely changed the way that I go about covering the NBA. When I have been caught in snippets of what I've said, completely stripped of context, it reminds me of how much the responsibility is when you are quoting a player or presenting something from a player or coach that may not show the full 360 degrees, and it's totally made me try to be more responsible in doing that. We will always make mistakes and we'll always fail because nobody is perfect. But you know, the problem is that with social media, it's become so easy to you know, create aggregation, and the aggregators are more incentivized to strip context at times because they're rewarded with engagement. And like, this is when for decades, when, you know, a player would say, well, you're just trying to sell newspapers. This is essentially the same kind of motivation. So like I said, there is a fine line that is there. And what you strive to do as someone who was a reporter is to be responsible. I mean, essentially, NBA Today, you know, we are taking the top 7 or 8 stories of the day and looking at them, breaking them down, examining them. Essentially, it's aggregating them. That's essentially what the show is doing.
Right.
So I am not taking a holier-than-thou position. I would just say that the level of irresponsible aggregation has caused immeasurable harm to my business, and has certainly encouraged me to be better, but is not always necessarily making the folks who are doing it elsewhere better. So it's very frustrating. It's changed how I've done my job on both ends. It's changed how you know, what I'm willing to discuss and how I discuss it. And it's changed how I do the job on the other end too, when I deal with primary sources.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really cool perspective. And that's one of my arguments when, say JJ Redick, for example, rips aggregate websites, that ESPN does aggregate information too, as you said, and reporters
only every day on every show.
Yeah. Reporters aggregate what players do and say we aggregate what reporters, hosts, and sports entertainers say. That's not to say that every aggregate website, as you noted, does it responsibly. I think there's certainly some that are more clicky than others and trying to attract clicks more aggressively than others. And I mean, I'm sure we've certainly fell into that category at times as well. And when we do, we usually hear about it from whoever we're writing about, or at least that company. So there's certainly a sense of trying to be responsible when aggregating, but whether you're aggregating like, sports or aggregating media, it is still aggregating content.
A lot of people always ask me about what happened last summer with that Utah Jazz thing.
Sure. Yeah. With the Rudy.
I was trying to avoid aggregation in the way I answered the way I was dealing with that.
Yeah.
Now there was a lot of factors that happened into that. And it wasn't like I said to myself, I'm avoiding aggregation with this I'm about to say. It just has framed the way I do my job. I knew that the Jazz were on the verge of trading Rudy Gobert. But it obviously might not have happened. Many, many, many trades get to the 1 yard line and don't happen. So if I were to come on and say the Jazz are very close to trading Rudy Gobert, but A, B, C, D, E, F, G, it would have immediately been put out there as I said that. And then if the trade didn't happen, which it almost happened the night before. It was like on the verge of happening the night before and didn't happen, which I knew about. It would have been looked at completely differently than if I presented it as, boy, there's this mystery happening right now and I don't know what's going on. And like I said, I did it so that I would not face having to defend, you know, a quote unquote report.
Right.
The thing that makes me the queasiest is when I see an aggregation site and it says report colon, because right. I'm like, huh. Well, when I report something, I file it to the ESPN news desk and there's a headline on it, you know, Jazz trade Rudy Gobert, or Jazz in talks to trade Rudy Gobert. That's a report. When I have said something on television or a podcast or a radio and it says report colon, before I even read the rest of the sentence, I'm like, oh boy, we got trouble, because you know, obviously when you say something on television, you are accountable for your words, and you shouldn't be coming up with it extemporaneously. You should know the question and know what your answer is going to be. That's what we spend the time doing, talking about it before the show and reporting before the show. But when I haven't framed something as a report and it comes back as report, that's when we get into dangerous zone. So, and I recognized over the years that, like, that's not necessarily the aggregator's fault. You know, it's my fault in the way I present the statement. So I've become way more precise in my language, or tried to at least become more precise in my language. And so when I think I've been precise in my language, and then I see report colon, I go, oh no, what happened? And again, that's the modern era. It is what it is. It's not anybody's fault. It's the real world we live in.
How often does a basketball fan now approach you with something to say about becoming a meme last year after teasing that Rudy Gobert news like you did on First Take?
A lot. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because there was a whole bunch of things that had to align for that to happen. I feel like there have been way other moments in my career where I kind of called something that was going to happen that just got no attention. And so it's funny to me that that will be potentially like the most remembered thing I do in my career. Cause you're like, well, wait a minute. What about when I said this about that? But I honestly, it was my reaction to it throughout that time was muted, because I know that it can swing both ways. What I did was not worth that reaction. It was not an appropriate reaction to that thing. And it just makes me worry that someday there will probably be a not appropriate reaction going the other way, where something happens and you are destroyed for something that really wasn't that big of a mistake, or maybe not even a mistake at all, just a perceived mistake. This was just, you know, it was correct, but it was not like, you know, forecasting. Like if I had come out on Sunday and said the PGA Tour is going to merge with the Saudi investment fund, now that would have been a report colon. That would have been calling something that was unbelievable. But I promise you, had I come out like on Friday and said I think this is going to happen, like what's going on with the PGA Tour, it wouldn't have gotten the same response. But it would have been a way more impressive forecast, put it that way.
Were you surprised how many people jumped to assuming your 72nd hit with Victor Wembanyama on lottery night was the only reason that you flew to Paris, and there wasn't even a chance that you could have been working on something else while you were there that we hadn't seen or read yet at the time?
Well, no, I mean, that's fine. That's the nature of it. Partially because I literally had just had a 5,000 word story run like that day, which of course, you know, I don't expect everybody, you know, there was millions of people watching the lottery. I didn't expect millions of people had read that story. And I'd also done a 5,000 word story on Wembanyama that published in February. And that was, you know, I covered game 6 of the Eastern, the Philadelphia, Boston series, flew overnight to Paris, didn't sleep, immediately went to the location where we filmed another Wembanyama interview, that hasn't run yet, because, you know, we're also, stockpiling stuff for the draft.
Right.
And, you know, you're not going to have access to him nonstop. I mean, they were doing this before this, the game that I went to the night of the lottery was the last game of the regular season. So they were basically like right at the end of the regular season. And he obviously wasn't going to do any extra media in the playoffs, and they're in the finals now. So like, that was a little window that we hit, but you know, to me, I happened to be in Toronto the night of the Connor McDavid lottery, like 2015-ish. I'm not a hockey fan, so I can't remember. But I will never forget that broadcast that I think the CBC did. And if it wasn't CBC, maybe it was TSN. Don't hold me to, I think it was the CBC, but don't hold me to that. And I just happened to be at this huge sports bar in Toronto when they had this lottery. And the Maple Leafs had, like, I think the fourth highest odds of getting this guy, Connor McDavid, who was the, like, the Wembanyama of the 2010s for hockey. Right. Maybe I'm getting this wrong. If you're a hockey fan, please don't skewer me.
I can't stop you on it.
Okay. So, but it was a really big deal. It had been like a lottery that had been looked forward to for a long time. And they do the lottery, and like within seriously 90 seconds, Connor McDavid is sitting on set with Elliot Friedman in studio in Toronto. And he's like, Connor, you're going to Edmonton. Your thoughts. And I always thought, like, wow, what amazing television that this guy literally found out where he's going to spend probably the most of, if not all of his NHL career. And we are getting his thoughts within, you know, 120 seconds. And I don't remember anything about the interview, but like, what an incredible thing.
Right.
And so I always remembered that. I always thought it was amazing. And when this opportunity presented itself and I saw the way it was going to play out, I was like, so we're going to be able to get Victor to give his reaction that fast. Like, what an opportunity. And the fact that it was also happening in the middle of the night in Paris, I mean, that's a one-off career opportunity.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, and here's the other thing, like, because of the week that I spent in Paris in January, I have met all of these people in his life, his parents, his coaches, not just his current coaches, his coaches when he was 12, his coaches when he was 14, his coaches when he was 16, teammates. So like at this party that he threw for this lottery, there's only like 60 or 70 people there. I knew like a dozen of those people and interviewed them with Jonathan Givony. Givony and I were over there. Givony was the face of the TV piece that, came out about it that we've run on ESPN dozens of times on all kinds of different shows. There will be more TV pieces coming. But the fact that I now have a basis of operations is invaluable with him, I now know his youth coaches and stuff. And right. So that was all huge. I think the fact that, that it happened the week of, I think there had been some ESPN layoffs that week, which obviously is unfortunate. I would just say that I've been in the media business for 23 years now. And unfortunately, I have been through layoffs at my company like 7 or 8 times. It is a reality of the media. It sucks. We lost colleagues. It's a real easy thing to poke at. I would just say that I think that week, well, I won't even go into the details. Let's just say that ESPN spends a lot of money on a lot of things.
Sure.
And it cost more money for me to cover the Eastern Conference Finals than it did for me to go to Paris. I understand that on the surface level.
Right, the optics.
You know, the optics were a certain way. But I thought it was an incredible once-in-a-career opportunity. And even if the interview wasn't good, which kind of how could it be? I literally had 75 seconds that I had a 75-second window because we had to start a Western Conference Finals game. And, you know, we were dealing with delays overseas and, you know, foreign crews and Victor himself having to do this in the middle of like the biggest moment of his life. You know, the fact that we were able to get him to talk about those things within 2 minutes, I thought was a great accomplishment, and I won't let anybody, put me off of it.
Did you do television when you were, before you came to ESPN, when you were working locally in Cleveland?
Very little. I mean, some, but nothing to speak of.
Was TV something that you wanted to do more of? Is it something that you thought you were going to be as good at it as you are?
I don't know if I'm good at it. It was not something that I sought out. I took no classes at all in college, not one college class on television. When I started doing TV at ESPN, I had the ESPN hired coaches to work with me, but I also had people at ESPN who completely took me under their wing and like taught me how to do it. Mark Schwartz, who's just recently retired. He's one of the best field reporters I've ever seen. I mean, I'm not comparing him to a war correspondent, just to be clear,
yeah,
but in terms of sports, on the road reporters, I couldn't have gotten better instruction. I mean, Rachel Nichols, couldn't have been more welcoming and helpful. You know, to me, like, you know, they gave me classes, producers behind the scenes. Melinda Adams, who is someone that you'll never hear her name, who is one of the most valuable people we have at ESPN, who has helped me behind the scenes for years. So, you know, I got in the field training, but I think what ESPN realized is that, you know, for decades, ESPN had these group, they called them bureau reporters because they'd be based in various bureaus, but like they would parachute in, like, you know, okay, this week they're covering, you know, a quarterback situation with the Chargers, and next week they may be at a golf tournament in Texas, and the week after that they might have to go cover the Major League Baseball playoffs. Certainly they had areas of expertise, but they were dropped in like, you know, paratroopers nonstop. And when ESPN.com started proliferating its hirings and started having reporters based with teams, they started realizing that having somebody on the ground who does those jobs in those specialty fields, like, you know, 365, the information could be really valuable, even if those folks weren't trained, you know, to be on television. If you put them around people that were super trained to be on television, whether it was the studio hosts or the people on the ground with them, that you would get better information because those reporters are there. And like Vince Doria, you know, who's since retired, guys like that who, brought that concept to ESPN, revolutionized it, you know, the way that they sort of brought reporters into it. And so basically, because I was on the ground and working the NBA 365, they appreciated that the information and the perspective had value, and they would teach me how to be a little bit on television. And so that's a phenomenon that I did not foresee coming, and obviously has changed my career. And one of the things that I respect mightily about and love about ESPN is the multi-platform nature of it.
Sure.
You know, the way that I can write, do various forms of television and do various forms of audio in different ways with some of the best people in the business every single day is what is so attractive about the place. And so for as much flack as ESPN takes, which, you know, is probably justified in a lot of ways, it's easy to forget that like there's a bunch of people who work at the company who are like really smart and like really good at their jobs and like have done some really cool things. And to be a part of that revolution, I mean, the greatest fortune in my career was to meet LeBron James when he was 14 years old. The second greatest fortune of my career was to become, a specialist reporter at a time where there was a desire from the biggest sports media company in the world to have specialty reporters. And so I owe as much of my success to those decisions and that track at ESPN, which I think has been amazing. It's benefited me, I'm biased, but it's been a huge, huge thing to help me, that they decided to go in that direction.
Yeah. You mentioned obviously knowing LeBron since he was 14. You're from Akron, Ohio. You covered LeBron in high school. You've covered him with the Cavs. You went to ESPN and Miami when he went to Miami. Even though you're not on the LeBron beat anymore, your careers are still linked in a way. Do you still have a relationship with him? Did you get to cover him more this year between the scoring record and just the Lakers being a little bit better?
No, I haven't really talked to him much at all in the last couple of years.
Still.
And that, excuse me. I haven't really gotten to talk to him much at all in the last couple of years. And that's just because my focus has been elsewhere. You know, I've been covering other teams, and also we have really good comprehensive coverage on the Lakers. You know, Dave McMenamin is an excellent reporter. Ramona Shelburne knows the Lakers as good as any media person has in the last 25 years. we have excellent Lakers reporters. And so I was there the night that he broke the record. And it was a walk down memory lane because, excuse me, so many of the people who were with him at the start were there. It was actually just an incredibly enjoyable night for me. But I didn't really work that night. I did a little bit of TV, but I was just sort of there. You know, Dave and Ramona were doing the heavy lifting. So, you know, part of it is it's just not my, you know, my quote unquote responsibility anymore. Obviously, I keep very much in touch with, you know, the folks who are around him. And certainly he is a topic of conversation regularly on ESPN. And sure. So I still do reporting around him. But it's, you know, I mostly spend time now in New York when I'm in studio. And I mostly spend time covering the Eastern Conference. I definitely still do Western Conference stuff, but I spend a majority of my time in the Eastern Conference. And so since he's gone to LA, I haven't been as around him. But, you know, I still will say that his career was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And absolutely, I benefited massively, massively from the opportunity to cover him. There's no question about that. I would not be anywhere near what I've accomplished today had it not been for LeBron. I completely agree with that, but it is not something that takes up as much time in my career now and hasn't for quite some time.
Was it hard going to Miami, leaving Cleveland, a franchise where you had already built relationships and connections, and now you're thrown into a new city to cover a different team, and you're doing it for a national outlet also, not as opposed to a local newspaper or something like that? Was there animosity from other beat reporters who had been there for years?
There was animosity from LeBron. he was not crazy about it. He didn't like the way ESPN handled the fallout from the decision. He felt like he got left alone on an island there. None of this is new information. I mean, this has been said for years. And he really didn't like the idea of ESPN creating a team of people just to cover the Heat, which was kind of revolutionary at the time, which I was the lead guy on. And it was pretty salty the first year. I mean, if I say anything that was difficult about it, obviously moving, I had never lived away from Northeast Ohio. I went to college in Northeast Ohio, and I mean, I'm from Akron, but I was living in Cleveland for those 7 years. So, you know, it's a 45-minute drive. I was still basically at home. So yeah, it was a challenge to move away from home. But I was like 30, how old was I? I was 32. I mean, I was a grown adult. It was fine. But, you know, the thing that was frustrating was that I was branded as a sycophant for going. And I was down here in Miami where I am right now for the finals. And like LeBron was like not giving me the time of day. So like if I was going to be branded a sycophant, at least I would get the benefits of being a sycophant, right? Like, you know, I'd be getting all the inside information and all the special access, but I wasn't. So that was a little bit frustrating. But again, I mean, like at the end of the day, who cares? You know, who cares? It's part of the deal. It's part of what you sign up for. And, you know, when you become a higher profile person, you face scrutiny. You know, like when you become an NBA player and you accept all of the benefits that come along with being an NBA player, it means that people are going to criticize you. When you become a national face that covers a high profile league like the NBA, people are going to criticize you. It is part of the deal. If you don't like it, you can leave. If I didn't like it, I could leave ESPN. I haven't been forced into this. I think it's a little bit, I don't think it has great perspective, but again, just like I would say about the aggregation, I would think that the NBA players who are criticized by people in the media or evaluated or reported on by people in the media probably think that we don't have the best perspective and we get it wrong sometimes. So I think, you know, it's part and parcel of doing it. So it was a bit of an adjustment when I first came to Miami, but now it's just a part of life. And I'm, you know, one of the things I'll say about LeBron that I feel pretty good about, he seems to be truly happy. He seems to be truly in a happy place. Maybe not when they lose in the playoffs, or maybe not when they have a bad season, as they've had a couple in LA, but my read on him is that he is a reasonably happy guy. And Me personally, I live a pretty happy life. And so there's a lot of people in the NBA who do extraordinarily well financially, have this great life, and they're not happy. So I think if you can achieve happiness in the profession, whatever profession you're in, you're ahead. It's would be probably the most important thing I could say to somebody who's starting out in the profession: find a job that makes you happy. It sounds basic and stupid, and I would have ignored it when I was 18, but I think it's kind of true. And I think LeBron's found it, and I know I have. And so, you know, if it means you get criticized every now and then, and that's fine.
That first year being a little rocky in Miami, covering the Heat and LeBron, do you think that was more so because of some like animosity towards ESPN, or was it just the fact that you went to Miami to cover the Heat? Like, would there have been an issue, do you think, if you got a job with the Miami Herald?
No, I think it was in Cleveland, where I had enjoyed basically a stress-free ride. I was covering a team that was extremely popular and for years had generally had nothing but good news. I mean, you know, they had some defeats in the playoffs and stuff, but in relatively medium-sized Cleveland, I enjoyed a very positive Q rating. And again, this is a place where I was born and raised. And so, you know, most of the stuff I was reporting on was positive. You know, that 60 win Cavs team was doing great. You know, I wasn't, you know, having to, I mean, I would criticize the team when I had to and criticize personnel moves, but you know, nothing was too severe. And then the city got hit with one of the worst, setbacks in sports. I say one of, because, you know, when I was 17, they lost the Browns. So one of the worst, you know, blows in the history of the sports of the city, which in a lot of cases defines the soul of the city. It's not like, you know, a river catching on fire, for example, but, you know, it felt that way to a lot of folks. And I became a sort of a secondary symbol of that. And so I wasn't used to it. I mean, I had a public Facebook page in 2010. You know, where like people could comment on it and my family would see it. And, you know, that was fine. That was no problem. You know, it was just, everything part of life. And I had to shut it down because I didn't want my family members to see what people were saying about me. And I literally have not been on Facebook since 2010. I had to get off because of that sort of stuff. And I don't think it was personal, but I was somebody that they could get to in a way and have vitriol. And so, but again, in the grand scheme of things, it's not like, the Ukraine war, I received some nasty things that people said to me in public and, you know, people shot spitballs at me when I would come to games and I had to shut down, you know, various aspects of social media. At the end of the day, it was fine. There's no problem, but you know, it was definitely an adjustment period. And, that's just part of life. But again, if you're going to take all that flack for being a sycophant, at least get the positive side, the positive aspects of being a sycophant. I didn't get the positive aspects of being a sycophant because I was doing a job. So that was the only thing that ever really was frustrating.
Did you know LeBron was going to Miami before the decision?
Before the actual show?
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew for about 12 hours.
12 hours.
And it kind of showed how in 2010, we weren't there with digital media because I had written a story that had posted on the Cleveland Plain Dealers website and had even tweeted it like all signs point to LeBron going to Miami. And I kind of felt like it was a little bit out there. I mean, we couched it because I didn't have it from LeBron's lips.
Yeah.
And there obviously could have been a change of heart. If you were on social media and following NBA people or reading the Cleveland Plain Dealers website, you would have seen that it had been reported. So when he said it, I was not surprised, but
right.
The world acted, Cleveland acted as if they had no idea it was coming. And so it was like a reminder in that time, like, boy, not that many people are maybe reading our website because we've had it up there for like seriously 12 hours. So, and what I remember about that night, you know, I elected not to go to Greenwich, Connecticut, where the decision was because I was told I couldn't get in. I decided to stay home, and that week had been crazy. You know, I'd been down at the meetings, standing outside the meeting, standing in the elevator bank, reporting on who was going up and down the elevator for 3 days, which was still we wouldn't be able to get that reporting today. That would all be covered up. But at the time, it just happened out in front of everybody. And so I was tweeting it. I mean, I think I started that week with 17,000 Twitter followers, and like I literally doubled my following within 3 days. I went from like 17,000 to like 35,000. And I was literally tweeting the real time LeBron free agent pitch stuff. And we even got a couple of small little comments from the people who were leaving, nothing substantive, but like we never get to cover free agency that way now.
Yeah.
Now it's all done behind closed doors, you know? And so like, it was actually an amazing week of reporting, like on the ground reporting, you know? Now it's all like you're talking to people and sources said and everything like this, but I was actually able to say, Mikhail Prokhorov just left, but Jay-Z stayed up for a private meeting with LeBron. LeBron is going way over with the Miami Heat, and the Clippers are having to just stand in the hallway and you know, twiddle their thumbs. Like, these were things I was witnessing with my own two eyes. I was reporting on Twitter in real time, but Twitter was still so small then that even though I was getting more followers, that I don't think anybody had noticed. And that was one thing that verified when it gut punched Cleveland. But anyway, that night, like an hour after the decision, when I got Dan Gilbert's letter emailed to me, I remember reading the letter and absolutely, I was in my basement. That was where I was, my office was. And I was laughing hysterically. Like I was laughing so hard, I couldn't even get through it. And it's absolutely not funny. Okay, that letter, if you remember, there is not one ha-ha or tee-hee in that letter. But the absurdity of the week all hit me at that moment. I just couldn't believe that this was happening. And like I was like looking at this letter going, I cannot believe this. And I still don't even understand why I was reacting that way. But I think that was like my emotional, like, you know, outpouring in that moment. And like I had talked to ESPN about potentially coming to work for him if LeBron went to Chicago or New York, because they had an ESPN Chicago and an ESPN New York. We didn't have any operation in ESPN in Miami. And so July, whatever that was, July 7th came and went, and they never said a word to me. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to stay in Cleveland and cover the Cavs, which I was perfectly happy to do. And then they called me like seriously, like in September. It was like literally months later. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know how this is all nonsense too far in the back. You don't care about any of this, but yeah.
No, I think it's interesting. I was actually curious if you had spoken to ESPN prior to him going to Miami, or if that was a product of the fact that it was Wade, LeBron, and Bosch all together, or if there was a chance that you were going to go, if he did go to New York, was there a chance you were going to cover him there, or if you were expecting the whole time to stay in Cleveland? I think that actually is an interesting note. Do you think that he really was contemplating retirement after getting swept by the Nuggets at all?
I don't want to get inside of his head. I don't want to make an assumption on what he was thinking. I think, you know, I'm a big actions over words guy. His actions indicate that he is going to definitely play one more year and then evaluate. And I would have guessed he was planning on playing two more years. So I will respect that he said that he was considering it. But his actions to this point have led me to believe that he's looking to play at least until he's 40. And he also had a very good season this year. I know he had some injuries. He made the All-NBA team. You know, his team got to the Western Conference Finals. It was a great season for him and the Lakers, all things considered. Obviously not a great start. Obviously the foot injury probably held him back to a lot of, you know, in the playoffs, but he is not coming off as somebody who's on his last legs. That said, I have seen guys retire before their time. I thought Ray Allen could have definitely played another year or two. When he said he was considering retirement at the end of the 2014 finals, I thought there's no way. And he never played again. I told this story, you know, in the locker room after the 2016 finals, Richard Jefferson announced his retirement. And I thought, there's no way, you are absolutely going to keep playing because you're still good. And he played three more years. I think two of which he actually played the third year, he kind of sat. But, you know, so I've been right and wrong on those. And I didn't get the feel that LeBron was done. But I will respect that he considered it, but I have not seen any action in the weeks since that indicates to me that that's what's going to happen.
You mentioned before that he seems happy in Los Angeles. Do you think there's a chance that he could play for a different team next year? Because I know those rumors have been no.
I think he will. I think he will be a Laker next year. The year after that, when it's possible Bronny comes in, I don't want to assume that. We'll see. But even then, it's a $50 million option. I think he'd like to, I think he's intending to play for the Lakers for $100 million over the next 2 years, but we'll see.
What's a rough estimate percentage of trade or transaction rumors that you see and hear that you actually report?
1%.
1%.
Yeah.
Do you ever sort of like roll your eyes at a rumor that gets reported? Like you hear something, you looked into it, you know it's not happening, you decide not to report it, and then somebody else goes ahead and reports it and tweets that information that you've already dismissed, and then it creates a bit of a social media firestorm.
Happened within the last 72 hours.
Happened with LeBron?
You know, sometimes you hear things and then you can't prove them. Sometimes you're directly leaked things that you don't. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
How do you even decide when something is worthy of being reported? Is there like a litmus test that you go through? Like, I'm sure the Knicks are probably having internal conversations about other team stars all the time, but yeah. At what point is it worth reporting on?
I mean, we're very, very collaborative at ESPN, especially with high level news items. There isn't many people in the NBA that we can't get to within a few minutes using our team, because we all aware of where our strengths and weaknesses are. So, of the transactions that happen, you know, there are some that I was completely unaware of, like, whoa, I did not hear about that. But most of the time when a transaction happens, I'm aware that it's coming, or I knew that it was possible. For example, and you'll get mad at me for saying this, and this will be aggregated, but like today I heard of a star player possibly being traded. If that star player gets traded in July, I would not be surprised. It's nowhere near ready for us to report on that possibility. It might not even be true. But most of the time when a transaction happens, we are some level of aware of it. And so your follow-up would be, well, then why don't you report it? How could you not give us the information? because the idea here is that when you report on something and say it, that it's correct and locked down. And sometimes, you know, the worst thing you can do is say, hey, I heard this guy might get traded, and he doesn't get traded. I mean, there are some guys where you hear they're going to get traded like 11 times and they don't, you know, and then it's the 12th time when the guy does. So over 20 years of being in the NBA, you know, like I spend humongous amounts of time during the day, talking to executives and agents and even some players — that happens more in person than on text — about machinations in the league. While we've been doing this podcast, I have about 17 text messages, and 10 of them are from executives or agents who are following up on stuff. That's not normal, but like we are now at the point where, you know, 3 weeks from the draft, or two and a half weeks from the draft or whatever. And, 3 weeks from free agency. So it's definitely churning now. You are basically reporting all the time. It's happening all the time. And so you're evaluating information as it develops. I wish I could say it was better than that, or it was a more clean way than that.
Yeah.
But that's just reality.
So obviously you were very careful with the Rudy Gobert stuff, but does just being a reporter in general make it harder to do First Take, because you discussing a rumor automatically gives it more clout than if Chris Russo were to be discussing a rumor on that show?
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Chris Russo is a better presenter than I am, you know? So, yes, I mean, it's a gray area. Like, look, there are times when I have absolutely screwed up and said too much and got out over my skis and been bashed in the nose because of it. There are times when I haven't said something that I wish I would have said. It is the nature of it. But one of the things I will say is there are literally a million stories that have happened, and there will be a million more. And I will exist in this world for a little period of time, and then they will move past me, and I will be long gone, and more stories will happen. Sometimes you will get a story, and it will be great, and nobody will remember it, you know, in 10 minutes or 10 months. Sometimes you will botch something and nobody will remember it. You either have a reputation of knowing what you're talking about or not. And I spend huge amounts of time trying, not always succeeding, trying to know what I'm talking about, whether it's with the series that I'm covering, whether it's with transactions, whether it's with, you know, coaching changes, whether it's what's happening with the league. You just put in the time to try your best and to do it your best. And you hope that on balance, what you present is reliable and that it will never be perfect. You will always make mistakes. You will continue to do it, but all you can stand on is your reputation. And like, we have people at ESPN who I believe, especially in our ESPN reporting group, whose reputations are really, really good. Like when they say something, bam, it is there. And we strive for that. And so I'd rather have a lower hit count. I'd rather have, you know, I'd rather have a better, you know, Q rating than, you know, a count that's out there. And that's the way I go about it. It doesn't mean it's the right way. It's the way I try to go about it.
Do you enjoy doing First Take and working with Stephen A. Smith?
Stephen A. Smith is an absolute mega, mega talent. I don't think people understand the amount. He is so good at what he does and the amount of energy that he has and what his days are like and the pressure that he's under. Like, I mean, again, he's not the president of the United States. He is extraordinarily talented. I mean, it is being able to work with him side by side and, you know, over the course of like a full day, it's awesome. Like no matter what you want to say about his takes, like you want to criticize his positions on things, cool. Like, you know, I'm not going to defend that, but like his ability to entertain and inform, the guy is amazing. And like, I'll say this, like Mike Greenberg. Okay. I have sat with dozens and dozens and dozens of hosts. The man is brilliant at his job. The way he takes the information and presents it, like, again, you can pick at him or whatever. I'm just telling you, on the front line, he didn't fall into that job on accident. You know, he wasn't somebody's son who, you know, who got taken care of. He is brilliant. Like, we have so many people. We have editors at ESPN that do things, Brandon, where you were there and you saw how the footage was captured or you saw how the script was, and they put these things together. They're these productions, and you're like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. Like, you can spend all day long picking at mistakes ESPN makes, and you can be right about all of them. But I am telling you, there are some absolute freaking studs at this company across the board. And like, and getting criticized and everything is totally part of it. I don't have a problem with it. It's fine. But like, there are like the people that I work with in our research department, I am telling you, if we sold access to our stats and information Slack during an NBA finals game, it would be like a major revenue center. Like, if you saw these people who were tracking these games with all of our resources and putting out this stuff, like you don't even have to watch the game. You could just watch that Slack channel go. Like, these people who are experts at that part of the job. Like, I mean, you know, it's an incredible privilege to be here. And people want to make fun of me for saying all that they can. I'm a realist. I'm just telling you how it is.
Did you work with Skip Bayless at all when he was there on First Take?
I did a couple of times.
Did you like that? Do you feel that his LeBron takes were authentic or shtick?
I didn't believe it at first, but I came to believe it. Here's the thing. Now in First Take, the cameras are on you at all times. I know they move on and off, but the cameras are on you all times. When Stephen A. and Skip started doing it, they would just sort of get the camera and the other guy would be off. And like Stephen A, like they'd be on Skip and Skip would be going with his take. And Stephen A already knew what he was going to say. And he's like, he didn't almost care. Stephen A would seriously pick up his phone Look at his phone. Stephen A. He loves breakfast sandwiches. You know, and I don't know if he still eats them, but he'd have a breakfast sandwich and he'd sit there. He literally would eat
during the show.
It was kind of like he was sort of a prop. He was sort of it wasn't on TV, but he was sort of like sending the message to Skip, like, go ahead and do your thing. I don't care.
Right.
So it was almost like it wasn't disrespectful. It was like it was interesting to watch. It was kind of surreal to watch because it would be like Skip's turn and Skip would go. And Stephen A. knew, okay, I've got 2 minutes here to just sit here and watch him. The first time I was ever on set for it, it was a really strange thing to see on set. But Stephen A. is, Skip is obsessive about preparation. Like Skip would be in that office at like way early in the morning and way afterwards. Like he, Skip would spend a lot of time researching. I assume he still does today. That's what I know him. But, and Stephen A. goes to the locker rooms. You know, Stephen A. is out there on the court. You know, he is out on the road. Stephen A. is out on the road going in the locker rooms, facing people, that wasn't something that Skip would do. And I don't think he does now. I haven't seen Skip in person since he went to Fox, but it was fascinating to be around that iteration of the show. And luckily, I was honored to be invited on a couple of times back then. So, but when you slice something on First Take, it gets seen in the NBA. maybe they're not watching live, but you show up around, you say something like, I was not on today, but I was on yesterday and I'm going to go see the guys who I was just talking about 6 hours later. It's a real thing.
Last thing is there a current player that you look at as having the potential to be a media star in retirement? Obviously, whether it's someone who has a podcast or not.
Draymond.
Yeah.
I mean, Draymond's it's already the there. Answer. And Draymond is wild, man, because he will say things like he is so savvy and seeing the game and so willing to say it. And then he will also say stuff that is absolutely not true. He was like, Draymond, what are you talking about? That is absolutely not true. He's just incredibly, savvy. I don't know if the star players will want to do that. First off, they're not going to need the money. they'd rather have spend their time. But, Draymond is probably going to be the next Charles Barkley.
Yeah. So we're not going to see LeBron James take over for Shannon Sharp, and it's going to be LeBron and Skip Bayless every day somewhere.
I mean, it would be incredible to see, but what does LeBron need that for?
No.
There's some loquacious guys and some guys who really know the league. And, I've been around long enough that some of the guys I'm working with, I saw their whole careers. So like I sit there and talk to JJ, we talk about stuff that I covered.
Yeah.
And I was on the other side of it, Perk, I covered Perk's whole career. His rookie year was my first year on the beat, I tell these stories. I won't tell them to you because they're private, but like stories of sitting in the green room with Scottie Pippen, who worked with us at ESPN, with current players or guys who just retired, and having Pippen tell stories of the Bulls and Jordan stories. Like, I was a kid when Scottie Pippen was dominating the league.
Sure.
That's pretty awesome. But, yeah, I think Draymond, it looks like he's going to be with Turner and not ESPN. But I would love to work with Draymond, especially since I covered all of those finals that he was in.
Yep.
I would love to go toe-to-toe with him and go back and forth about some of his stuff. And he could tell me I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I would say, you are being a hypocrite, and we could go back and forth. Maybe someday that'll happen.
Brian, thank you so much for all the time. I really appreciate it. I'll let you get to answering some of those text messages.
All right. Talk to you later.
That is Brian Windhorst. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. As always, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com. And follow us at Awful Announcing.